from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Senator Elizabeth Warren talks with us about her work in the U.S. Senate and her new book.
We have to be in this fight right this minute. This is what has changed in democracy in America. It's not the case that we can simply put this off.
Also today, our Week in Review team looks back at the busy week in the news, including the state drug lab scandal and the suicide of former Patriots player Aaron Hernandez.
Our response is going to be primarily to investigate, to make sure that everybody understands exactly what happened and when and why.
Plus, we go into the kitchen of Somerville restaurant, Sarma.
I think in a time when people are really quick to kind of like jump around, I am more like, let's make this place great, making it the kind of place that people are going to come to for years on end.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As we approach the 100-day mark of the Trump administration, perhaps the person who has emerged as one of the president's fiercest opponents is our own Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Her new book is titled The Fight is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class. The book opens on election night in 2016 with Warren describing President Trump as the man who could deliver a knockout punch to America's middle class. Senator Warren is on the line now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Senator.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how could the president deliver this knockout punch to the middle class? And why is your book about that fight in particular?
Well, what I try to do in the book is tell the long arc story, starting really back in the 1930s, about how as we came out of the Depression, that pretty much everything that came through Washington was filtered to how do we build opportunity and strengthen the middle class. Think about it. You know, like the GI Bill and more investment in education and infrastructure and the national highway system and power grids out in rural areas and investment in research so that we really built this vibrant, growing economy and good, solid jobs for the middle class and lots of opportunities for people who were lower middle class and working families and the poor, poor, everybody. And it really worked for a long time. And then starting in about 1980, Ronald Reagan, trickle-down economics, deregulate, turn loose of the big banks, let them do what they want, giant corporations, turn them loose, less antitrust enforcement so they could roll over small businesses. And the big one, cut taxes for those at the top. And that meant less money to invest in education, less money to invest in infrastructure, less money to invest in research. And for, you know, since 1980 to right now, it's kind of been one punch after another at the middle class. And what I worry about now deeply is that Donald Trump really could deliver the knockout blow. Let me describe it this way to you, if I can, Deborah. 1935 to 1980, GDP is going up, and the 90% of America, everybody outside the top 10%, the 90% of America gets 70% of all new income growth generated in this country. And that's true upper middle class, working class, working poor, poor, poor. In other words, the pie got bigger and we all got a little more to eat. 1980 to 2016, GDP keeps going up, but the 90%, everybody outside the top 10%, how much did they get of the new income growth? The answer is zero.
But you know, I think
nothing.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Senator.
But right.
But I think that same sentiment and that feeling of being left out of the growth is also what helped get Donald Trump elected.
I agree.
There are folks who said, you know, we need this to change. I am not getting by like this, and the government isn't working for me. And they felt that things were rigged against them. What do you say to the folks in Massachusetts who supported Donald Trump and that change that they wanted to see?
Look, I think that Donald Trump correctly saw the anger in America. he saw that people are angry. They work hard, they play by the rules, and they just don't have a chance to get ahead. People are angry that their kids can't get an education without getting crushed by student loan debt. They're angry that we've got a tax system that puts the best jobs overseas and doesn't put those jobs here in America. They're angry that people at the top don't pay their fair share and our infrastructure is crumbling around our ears in some places. They're angry at our inability to build a stronger and more robust economy that gives them a chance and gives their kids a chance. The difference is that while Donald Trump saw the anger, he just never, he pointed in the wrong direction for what caused it. He wanted to point in a very different direction. He said it's their fault. It's the fault of immigrants. It's the fault of people who don't worship like you. It's the fault of people who don't look like you. And then when he got in office, after having promised he would be there for working people, he's just turned around and handed the keys to government to a bunch of billionaires and bankers, and now they're delivering one punch to the middle class after another. You know, it's stuff, Deborah, that's not even, it doesn't even show up in the headlines because there's so much going on, but Trump has signed into law a bill that makes it easier for federal contractors to steal their workers' wages, a bill that makes it easier for employers who kill or maim their employees to hide that fact, a bill that makes it easier for investment advisors to cheat retirees. And to me, Trump Care just said it all. Take 24 million people, take away their health care coverage, raise the cost of health insurance for a bunch of middle-class families, and do that, why? So that you can produce a tax cut for a handful of millionaires and billionaires. I mean, my real point is America's middle class just can't take that kind of punch anymore.
You know, some critics say that you yourself, Senator, are removed from the middle class. They say that your tax returns showed that you made a couple hundred thousand dollars a year teaching at Harvard. Your house in Cambridge was assessed at a few million dollars. What do you say to those folks?
So, look, this is where I came from, and this has been my entire life's work. I grew up in a family that was barely hanging on to its place in the middle class. When I was 12, my daddy had a heart attack. He was out of work for a long period of time. The bills piled up. Our family's station wagon was lost. We were right on the edge of losing our house. And I listened to my mother cry every night about what was going to happen to us. And she was 50 years old. She'd never worked outside the home. And I remember the day when my mother pulled on her best dress, her high heels, put on her lipstick, and walked to the Sears to get a minimum wage job. And that minimum wage job is what saved our home, and it saved our family. And for me, the way I understand that is it worked because a minimum wage job, back when my daddy had a heart attack, was thought of in Washington as what does it take to support a family. So Washington had set the minimum wage at a level where it supported a family of three, where it paid a mortgage, where we could actually get back on our feet and make it. Today, just by contrast, a minimum wage job won't keep a mama and a baby out of poverty, won't support a two-bedroom apartment in any city in America. A minimum wage job today, how does Washington think of it? They think of it in terms of profits for McDonald's and profits for Burger King and profits for Walmart. They don't think of it in terms of what it takes to support a family. In other words, this is one of the big themes of the book, is that Washington once worked for families, and today Washington works just for those at the top. And I talk about in the book the reason for that shift and how money has completely changed how Washington works. And I talk about how to fight back against that.
Right, I understand that, but there are folks who wonder if you do enough to walk the walk. I wonder, well, what's the message to those folks? What do you say to them?
Well, this is what I do every day. This is what I fight for and what I fought for long before I ever got into politics. You know, this is my 11th book, and my books have all been about, basically, about what's happening to working families in this country. This matters to me. It matters to me in a very personal way. You know, maybe I can say it another way that may explain this. I wanted to be a teacher. It's all I ever wanted to be in my life, public school teacher. And when the time came for me to go to college, there wasn't any money for that. But I got a scholarship in debate. I got married young, gave up the scholarship, and I thought it was all over for me. My big chance came from going to a commuter college that cost $50 a semester. And that college opened the door for me. I became a special needs teacher. I had other opportunities. I got to go back. I got to go to law school, a public law school that cost $460 a semester. And I am deeply grateful down to my toes, because I understand that I got chances because I grew up in an America that was investing in its kids, an America that was opening up opportunities, an America that was bending the arc in the direction of more opportunity. And I look around this America today, and I say, that's not where we're headed. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing today is closing off one opportunity after another. You know, in this book, I talk about Kai. I talk about a lot of people, but Kai, a young woman who heads off to college very much like I did. She starts out to college. She's going to work in the computer field. She has a solid plan, but she gets her feet tangled up with a for-profit college, and by the time I pick her up in the book, she's 27 years old. She has no college diploma. She has $100,000 in student loan debt, and she's working as a waitress. And here's the part that just twists the knife. The United States government is making a profit off Kai's student loans. Hmm. So I introduced a bill in Washington to cut the interest rate on student loans. I've worked on trying to get more investment into public universities. I've worked on trying to crack down on for-profit colleges that cheat kids like Kai. But here's the deal. When I tried to get the student loan bill through, the Republicans filibustered it. And here's the reason why. Because to pay for it, that is to reduce the interest rate on student loans, and to make up the gap in the budget, because the government right now is making a profit off them, I proposed for this, stitching up a tax loophole that applied only to millionaires and billionaires. And the Republicans said no. It was more important to protect that tax loophole for people who are already making millions or billions of dollars.
I want to just
interest rate on student loans for Kai.
I want to just make sure we get to a couple of things. You know, when you say that, it brings up something. We had a WBUR poll recently that showed that you have almost zero support among Republicans. And I know that this is part of a big divide in Washington. And we also have heard from State Representative Jeff Deal. He was co-chair of President Trump's campaign here in Massachusetts, exploring whether to run against you. I mean, this divide threatens a lot of things. I'm wondering what you think about that and if you think it makes you vulnerable.
Look, this is the work I do. It's the work I did long before I ever got into politics, and it is the work I will continue to do. I will go to Washington every day that the people of Massachusetts send me there to fight on behalf of working families, to fight on behalf of opportunity for kids like Kai, to fight on behalf of strengthening and expanding Social Security so that people have a chance to retire with dignity. That is my life's work. That is what I will work on. And, you know, the politics will be where they are. But I know why it is that I first ran for the Senate, and I know what I try to do every day. And I'm not changing that to try to, you know, do some kind of political thing. That's just not what it's about for me.
You know, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has been saying that the Democrats need to look at the election of Donald Trump, and the way for them to succeed going forward is to move more to the left. Do you agree with that?
No, I have to say, I'm not sure that left-right politics is the way to describe America anymore. I think it's clear that all the Republicans, because they've stood pretty elbow to elbow in terms of making sure that there are more tax cuts for the rich and powerful. You know, they have a whole set of things they've worked on, but there have been a lot of Democrats who've helped them on that. There's no doubt about that. I really think the divide now is whether you're out there to build some opportunity, whether you believe in fighting for working people. The way I always think of it is whether you believe in an America, in a government that works just for those at the top, or one that's really working for the rest of America, trying to create the opportunities there. And I think there's some real cut across the divisions. Actually, you know, I can give you an example of that. I started in several years ago saying that we should break up the biggest financial institutions, the big banks. They wrecked our economy, and these big banks ought to be broken up through Glass-Steagall, and we would have ordinary, regular banking, you know, your checking account and savings account. And on the other side, they could go take risks on Wall Street, but they can't use your checking account and savings account money in order to do that. Divide them up and break them up. Wouldn't affect community banks, wouldn't affect our credit unions. It's just the big guys it would hit. Now, there's an example of something that is bipartisan, at least. My co-sponsor on that bill is John McCain, and Maria Cantwell from Washington is on that bill, Angus King from Maine. And Donald Trump said during the campaign that he was in favor of adopting Glass-Steagall, this 21st century Glass-Steagall, as I call it. And Donald Trump's top economic advisor has now said he'd be willing to consider it. It was in the Republican platform and in the Democratic platform. So to me, there's an area we could work together. We could work together to say this government is not supposed to be here all the time to make life better for the richest people in this country and the biggest corporations in this country. Let's work together. Let's do a Glass-Steagall. And I mean that quite sincerely. Come on, Mr. President. You know, I'll round up some Democrats. You round up some Republicans. Let's get this thing through Congress. There's a place we could act in a very bipartisan way for the good of the country. There might be six or eight giant financial institutions that might not like it, but I sure think it'd be good for the rest of us.
Just briefly, in your book, you write about that you did at one point really think about perhaps running for president, or at least there was a lot of speculation going on, and you asked your husband what he thought as to whether you should run. Do you think you should have run?
You know, look, right now, I'm very sorry that Donald Trump is president of the United States. And I'm sorry, not because of the things he says or the things he tweets. I'm sorry because of the things he is doing. I'm sorry because of the laws he's signing off on. I am sorry because of the kind of health care, Trump care, that he is advancing. We can all sit around and say woulda, coulda, shoulda. But the real point, and the point I talk about in this book, is so what are we going to do now? What are we going to do to get in the fight and to make sure that our voices, the people's voices, get heard in Washington? This book, ultimately, is a book that is about optimism. It's a book that says democracy can work. It works if we all get in there and make our voices heard. All those phone calls to Washington a few weeks ago and those protests and showing up at town halls, That's a big part of the reason that 24 million people didn't lose their health care coverage. I know the Republicans may come back next week on it, but the point is, it was a Democratic moment, small d Democratic. The Democrats didn't have enough votes to stop it. We don't have the votes to stop it in the House or in the Senate. But people across this country made their voices heard. And when they made their voices heard, there were some Republicans who said, no, we need an even more brutal version of Trump care. But there were a lot of Republicans who wouldn't follow them over that cliff and who listened to the people and said, we're not just going to repeal Obamacare and run away. We're not just going to rip away health care for 24 million people. We're not just going to drive up the cost of insurance even higher for millions of Americans. And that's a good thing. That's an optimistic thing. So I spend a lot of the book telling stories, but talking about how you can get in the fight, how you can be in the fight, and how you can be effective in the fight.
All right, Senator Elizabeth Warren, I know that we've already taken more of our allotted time, so I appreciate you being with us. Her book is This Fight Is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class. Thanks so much. I hope you'll be on the show again soon.
Thank you. I'd love to.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, before we get to our regular week in review, where we go through some of the other news of the week, I want to get our panelists' reactions to what Senator Elizabeth Warren just said right before the break. Arlene Isaacson is with me in the studio. She's political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, nice to be here.
Also with us, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Hi there.
Happy to be here.
So, Elizabeth Warren, who was just on the air with us, talking about her new book. I wonder, Arlene, your thoughts about some of the things she said about her book and her priorities.
Well, I think she actually captured precisely the dynamic that we're struggling with in this country right now, which is the change in public policy since approximately 1980-ish in how we focus our laws and our regulations, whether they're oriented towards helping working class and middle class folks to provide them more opportunities, or whether it's reoriented just a little bit at the beginning. I think, you know, if you know how math and geometry works, you know that a tiny change in the angle of something at first is just a small change in the angle, but as it grows out over time, it gets larger and larger and larger. And I think that's what happened. Changes were made in the 80s that seemed perhaps small at the time, but the ramifications have been hugely negative for the middle class in this country, and she really put her finger right on it.
Mm. And Richard?
There's a lot going on economically in the country, but I kind of find her premise that the middle class has been hammered to be a real indictment of the last 8 years. I mean, you know, President Obama's been in, and you're in the 8 years of Bill Clinton, you know, if you're talking about what's happened since 1980. And the other thing I'd just say is, you know, she has a lot of, when you listen to her, a lot of great rhetoric, but at the end of the day, I think there are a lot of people in the state who want to see results, and she really does, you know, one of the reasons I think she's been having so much trouble in recent polling, I know WBUR did a poll, and there have been a couple of other public polls released that show that she's not in the greatest position for re-election, is because I think people want to see our elected officials in Washington work together. And she had talked a little bit about working together during the interview, but there really aren't any examples where she's been able to cross the party lines to get anything done. And, you know, Massachusetts, I think, is getting hurt right now.
Well, you know, I have to say, though, it's a bit unfair to use the metric of have you gotten anything done since the Republicans have controlled Congress and the Senate. So were the other party in control, there's a lot she could have gotten done. But right now, she's fighting right now. You know the expression, who's watching the watchdogs? Well, Congress should be our watchdog. Mm. But who's watching them? I believe that she's doing a fabulous job watching them and calling them out when they do things which are disadvantageous for the middle class.
But, you know, there are a lot of bread and butter issues here in Massachusetts that it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, you should be tending to. And I think that, you know, this is a Democratic state, but I do think that there's a feeling that she's more interested in, you know, throwing rocks and, you know, fighting it out down in D.C.
rather than example? Here. Give me an example of one of those issues. You feel like she's not.
You know, there was a bill up not too long ago that had to do with funding for medical research that President Obama had to call Governor Baker to, you know, to try to win support, you know, get some support ginned up in Massachusetts because Elizabeth Warren was earing against President Obama on that. And we, you know, we're obviously a state that does pretty well research-wise, from the federal government. That it would have been great to have our senator front and center supporting the bill.
Well, you know, on the other hand, though, our economy, this state in particular, is so founded in our higher ed institutions, and she understands clearly more than many in Congress the importance of dealing with student loan debt and reducing the amount that kids have to pay for those student loans and the ramifications on their lives. That is a quintessential bipartisan, should be a bipartisan issue.
I think we have to agree that it's really tough for anybody to do anything. There's no bipartisan atmosphere in general now, right?
True.
No, it's difficult. It's difficult there, but, you know, she's become a great national figure. Maybe she'll run for president. Maybe that's what the book tour is all about. But I do think at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of people who want to see her in the state doing things for Massachusetts. And, you know, Ted Kennedy was great, you know, in that he was a liberal icon and did, you know, a lot of had a national profile. But I got to tell you, he was great doing all the bread and butter issues here from Massachusetts, and we don't really have a senator right now who is doing that in the same tradition that he did. And I think that's the point, and I think that's what's hurting her in Massachusetts.
Invoking
some of these
Ted Kennedy. Just pointing that out.
I actually think she does a lot more of that than she's given credit for, and I actually think that there's a little bit of a judgment that may be slightly gender-based, not from you, Richard, but from some in terms of how she works versus Kennedy.
Okay, let's move on to the news of the week, first of all, because we had a very busy news week. First of all, we had the Aaron Hernandez story, his apparent suicide, former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez, we should say, his apparent suicide in prison early Wednesday. And, you know, here's Governor Baker promising a complete investigation from the State Department of Correction. Let's listen.
Look, anytime anybody kills himself in a prison, something clearly went wrong, although as one of the prison advocates said, that can be a tough issue to manage sometimes. But obviously the investigation that DOC will do will hopefully give us some guidance on steps we could take going forward.
Now, we should say that what we know at this point also is that state law in Massachusetts allows Hernandez's legal records to be wiped clear because he was still appealing his murder conviction. The lawyer for the family of Odin Lloyd, that's the man Hernandez was convicted of killing, spoke with reporters today, and they're calling on the Patriots to pay some $6 million to Hernandez's estate. They say that money should be made available to their family. Here's Ursula Ward. She is Odin Lloyd's mother.
It's not even about Odin Lloyd. It's about the person that committed the crime for Odin Lloyd. If it wasn't for that, you guys wouldn't be here to ask me questions about Odin Lloyd. So today I'm speaking up for Odin Lloyd and for the families out there that is fighting for justice.
So Richard, I'm wondering, what do you think this high-profile prison suicide of Aaron Hernandez, how does that affect the image of Massachusetts?
I think the whole situation has been stunning, watching it, and who would have thought that it would have ended, you know, that he would have committed suicide the day that the Patriots are literally celebrating at the White House. But, you know, I think, you know, there are 10,000 prisoners under the control of the Department of Corrections. Obviously, they can't watch every prisoner 24 hours a day. I mean, if you're intent on taking your own life, it's pretty hard, I think, to stop that from happening. Obviously, the governor's right. There needs to be an investigation to make sure that all the policy and procedures, were adhered to. But again, if somebody's intent on doing that, and maybe he did it for the financial benefit,
right, because the slate would be wiped clean, and so then that money might be available.
And from what I understand, he also had the opportunity to get. He qualified for a pension from the NFL. Maybe that would come into play. So, you know, just a bad situation all the way around.
But, you know, there are a lot of folks who are saying, questioning whether he could commit suicide under those circumstances and why he would have done it just days after he was acquitted of a double murder, because he was also charged with the double murder in Boston. And he was acquitted on Friday, and on Wednesday morning he's found dead in his cell. And some folks, you know, say that the Department of Correction is not being transparent enough. We have a clip here from George Leontire. He's a lawyer for Hernandez's family. He was in court this afternoon criticizing the Department of Corrections for not being transparent enough. Let's listen.
They should have talked to Mr. Leontire and the family the night he died, or the morning he died, and they should have told them about suicide notes before they had to read it in the newspaper.
So because apparently now we found out that the Worcester County District Attorney is saying there were three suicide notes in his cell, and initially they said there was no suicide note. So I'm wondering, Arlene, you know, does this raise big questions, do you think, about our Department of Correction and about how an investigation like this is handled?
You know, it's a fair question, but I tend to look at this from a little bit more of a 30,000-foot level. First, it's a tragedy in so many ways for so many people involved, for the Odin Lloyd's family, for Aaron's family. But it's kind of sad that the issue of how people live in prison are treated and investigated and why that there'd be suicides becomes an issue only when it's a famous person involved, when unfortunately it happens at other times and in other ways, particularly for people who have been in solitary confinement, which I realize he was not. I also, though, look at it from the good point of view that it's wonderful that the family decided to donate his brain, crass as that may sound, to have CTE investigated to see if he suffered from chronic traumatic, I'm going to struggle with this, encephalopathy. Thank you, encephalopathy, which, as some people know, is a brain disease that comes from the trauma that so many football players undergo with the brain concussions. So, and CTE apparently can cause depression, aggression, suicidality. So it'll be important to look at that. But the details of some of this, I think, go beyond that. They go to how all prisoners are treated.
Mm-hmm. They found the suicide notes after he had committed suicide. And if he had mentioned that or they had any indication, they would have obviously.
But their first statement said no note.
No, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But, you know, I mean, he wasn't being watched for being at risk. I mean, he had just, like, he had just won a big trial. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would have thought that this would have been, you know, wouldn't have been the time that he would have been doing. So, you know, there was a lot of general shock.
I just want to also bring up another criminal justice-related story, and that was the almost end of a chapter in the state drug lab scandal. We found out this week that some 21,000 criminal cases are going to be dismissed involving former state chemist Annie Ducon. She went to prison for 3 years for falsifying drug tests. And, you know, it's been a long, five-year-long legal fight over what to do about this bad behavior in a state lab by Annie Ducon. And we just, you know, after the SJC ruled in January that prosecutors had to identify cases, they identified 24,000. The court said, tell us which ones you're going to dismiss. Just this week, we got the certification that 21,000 cases will be dismissed, believed to be the largest in U.S. history. What do you think is the conclusion of this story, Arlene?
It's a very interesting and sorrowful tale. I know that the ACLU, public defenders, a lot of pro bono law firms worked on this for a long time trying to get through this mess. And it's a pity that some of the district attorneys fought so long and so hard and wasted, candidly, so much taxpayer money doing so when these cases could have been dealt with several years ago. The biggest problem, in my opinion, is that it's not necessarily about Annie Ducon, and there's also a similar case out in Western Mass where another problem drug lab. But it's really very much a result of the failed war on drugs where you criminalize drug behavior. And so a lot of the people who were put in jail were there for mere possession, sort of low-level crimes. Most of those are low-income or poor black and brown people whose lives were hurt irreparably, not simply because they spent time in jail, but because after coming out, they'd have a hard time getting employment, have a hard time getting housing. So it speaks to the fact that we really need to revisit how we're handling the drug war and if we shouldn't be slotting people more towards treatment than towards prison
And what's your take on it?
I agree with what we just said. Yeah. I think what I find stunning about this is that she's out on parole. She had a 3-year sentence, and the damage and the consequences of her actions are so widespread. I mean, you have people who are in jail who are falsely convicted based on evidence that she tainted. And then you have thousands of people who are guilty, who were released or are going to have their records expunged. That's also repercussions from that. So I mean, the fact that she, not only her but her supervisors, seem to all get off scot-free. Managers at the company that she was the drug lab she was at. I just find it rather surprising.
I want to finally move to our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories that may not have made it above the fold but caught our attention, and we have very limited time left, so I'm going to have to ask you to be very concise. Arlene, what's your hubbub for the week?
Mine is for hub lovers and about Art Week this week, coming along soon. The Old South Meeting House, which is in downtown Boston at Downtown Crossing, sponsors a lot of wonderful programs and tours in and around the city. And in 2 weeks, they're holding their annual quiz show on Boston history. So Sue Wilson, who, as many know, is an acclaimed photographer and author and a Boston historian, runs each year this quiz show on various aspects of Boston's long and interesting history. So on May 3, the Old South Meeting House is going to have a quiz show that will focus on the vibrant newcomers from around the world who shaped our neighborhoods. It's always a fun, interesting, educational night, and I encourage people to go.
All right, Richard.
And just a quick shout out to Sydney Chafee, who was she's a ninth grade humanities instructor.
Yeah, we had her on the air yesterday. Yeah. National Teacher of the Year.
Mm-hmm. Very impressive. The first time in 65 years a Massachusetts teacher has been honored. And she's a charter school teacher. The first time that's happened as well.
All right.
So pretty good.
Okay, so I'm going to try to do this really fast. What's a Southie? Anybody know? What's a Southie? That's right. Well,
the New York Times,
a neighborhood, but the New York Times got some flack this week because they called Barbara Lynch a Southie. And people said, no, a person is not a Southie. A neighborhood is a Southie. The Times used the term not once, but twice in a story. Now, I don't want to make fun of other journalists or anything. It's more making fun of how provincial we can be here. The Boston Globe then asked Barbara Lynch, Chef Barbara Lynch, and she said she never claimed to be a Southie. But if people from Southie started calling themselves that, she would be proud to be one. So there we go. What is a Southie? Anyway, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, thanks so much for being with
us. Thank you.
Also, Richard Tassay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate.
Thanks to you as well.
Nice to see you. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Somerville restaurant Sarma has been in business just 3.5 years, and co-owner and executive chef Cassie Puma has already racked up several awards. She made Eater's list of best restaurants in America, and she just received her second James Beard nomination for Best Chef Northeast. Puma co-owns the restaurant with other business partners, including Anna Sortoon from Oleana. At one time, Puma worked at Sortoon's Cambridge restaurant, Oleana. We wanted to find out how Puma earned such rave reviews, so we stopped by her kitchen this week. While whipping up a complex Middle Eastern-inspired dish, she explained why she dropped her pre-med plans for a career in the kitchen.
For you guys today, I'm going to make the cauliflower fatih. Fatih is a layered bread dish. It hails from Lebanon. This is a very interpretive version of the traditional one, but I think typically you would find meat or vegetables that get layered with like fried bread of some sort and yogurt. It's a lot of fun to eat. Like, it's got a lot of texture and interesting layers of flavor. I hate saying that. It sounds like every chef says that all the time, but it really does. It's just like layers and layers of different flavors and textures. I'm going to start by getting a pan nice and hot here with lots of olive oil. And I have some different colored cauliflower.
Why Middle Eastern cooking?
Why in general?
Yeah, why did you decide to open a restaurant that focused on Middle Eastern cooking? It's got a whole Middle Eastern theme. You've got turquoise,
sure.
Purple, you've got the mosaic lamps. It's very Middle Eastern. Why was this the kind of, what drew you to this type of cooking?
I think it's, you know, exciting food. It has lots of spices and herbs and really deep flavors. It's rich and satisfying without being heavy or, you know, cloying. I'm, you know, half Greek, so I kind of grew up eating a lot of feta cheese and olives and things like that, so I think it's kind of in my blood. But I also worked at Oleana for over a decade in Cambridge. That was a big part of my education. I really grew to love the flavors there as well, so. I hate mushy vegetables, and I like cauliflower a little more al dente, so I'm going to try to get a nice sear on one side but keep the other side a little crispy. People get scared when they watch us season because we have an open kitchen so you can see everything. We really like to push the levels of salt in this kitchen.
You got quite a wrist flip there to put the salt on. It looks very, I'm intimidated by the wrist flip. I just want to say.
It's fun. I love watching people season their food.
Now, I see other women working here.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got primarily a woman-dominated kitchen.
Yeah, at this point, we are an almost all-female kitchen, which we're really proud of. We have two men working who are great, and, you know, I support women in this industry, and I think that the women who do work here are extremely focused and driven, and they really make this place feel special. Like, the energy, the female energy can be really wonderful.
Is it unusual to have an all-female kitchen?
Yes. I think that women are driven to other, you know, strong women, and they want to be in sort of a like-minded kitchen and atmosphere, place where they feel comfortable to kind of express their views and, you know, really be themselves. And
I think those pots are boiling over. Holy cow. So we're not ruining your meal, are we?
Oh, no. It's just a delicious scum that comes off the chickpeas. Probably shouldn't use that word, but that's what we call it.
We recently had Chef Barbara Lynch on our show talking about cooking and her new book, and you worked with her.
I did. I love Barbara. She's the greatest. I worked there for at the butcher shop for about a year.
You know what she said to us that was interesting was that she said she wasn't a foodie. If she's alone, she has a very simple meal, but it's something about cooking for others that really motivates her. Are you in that same camp, would you say? Or
I would say so. I mean, I have pretty simple, straightforward tastes. I think in my own time, you know, when I'm cooking at home, I just kind of want like a roasted chicken and some potatoes.
Right. Well, I could understand it. You know, it can be tiring to cook all the time, even when in your downtime. But I also wonder if there's something else there about nurturing people. That's sort of what cooking does for you. That's
sort of
to make this, you know, to please other people with food. What is that?
You live for the smile. You live for the smile that it puts on people's faces. And I don't think it comes from like a narcissistic, like, hey, look at my food. Look what I did for you. I really think it comes from like almost like a maternal, like, you know, whatever happened during your day that maybe wasn't so good. Maybe you got yelled at by your boss or your kids were being a pain. You get to come out and, you know, have this really nice, relaxing meal, and you get to feel special and walk out of here feeling better than when you came in.
It's a good goal.
I would try.
When did you decide you wanted to cook? You went to school for pre-med initially, right?
I did, yeah. I went to school for pre-med.
Nurturing. Different kind, right?
Sure. I wanted to help people, I think, but I was a little misguided. I think I just thought that's what, I mean, I went to like kind of a college preparatory school and, you know, I got good grades and kind of focused in school and I just thought that's what you do. It wasn't really for me so much in the fact that it was very black and white. There wasn't a lot of creativity and there wasn't a lot of room for, you know, expressing ideas. With cooking, it's, you know, the possibilities are sort of limitless and you can really, it's art.
I've been here before. It's fabulous. And I love when the servers come out and ask us if we want the chef special, right?
Right,
is that
yeah.
what it's, it is what it's called. Am
yeah,
I saying the right
yeah, sure.
thing?
Yeah.
And sort of what's not on the menu. Where did that idea come from and how does that work exactly behind the scenes?
Well, when Anna and I were on a trip to Turkey, before we opened Sarma, we were investigating Mejanes, which are a traditional sort of like a kind of like a taverna or a drinking house where people kind of congregate in Turkey to socialize and to drink, of course, and then to have like some small bites. And they do it sort of in an unusual way where a server will come around with this like big giant silver tray, and sort of like dim sum, it will have everything sort of pre-plated, and you visually kind of take a gander, and then you point to which items you want, and then they'll take off and then come back with the dishes that you pointed to. So we kind of worked off that concept a little bit, but what we actually do is like it's more of a, you know, in the moment kind of experience. So we plate the special dishes, you accept the dish off the tray, and it actually comes to you right in the moment. You don't have to like wait for it. It doesn't come back from the kitchen, which is kind of great. So it kind of gets people involved in the experience.
And so every night, are you back here thinking, what's going to be our special that we're going to take out tonight and see if people want to try? And
there's a few dishes that make their way on the rotations like more frequently. For example, our sesame fried chicken, which that might be the signature dish. That one has a bit of a cult following.
I'm a culty.
Are you?
Oh,
are you in it?
Oh, it's so good.
I love it too, but I think I don't know if I can ever come back from when I experimented with it. I tested it like for 3 weeks straight when I first put it on the menu, and I look at it sometimes and I don't know if I can get past the fact that I ate like 3 weeks worth of fried chicken. Alright, so this is starting to look pretty good. So let's see, we have the black garlic tahini on the bottom, the crispy bread, the seared cauliflower tossed with a little tomato garlic confit, and then I'm gonna spoon over this seasoned local yogurt.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
And now pine nuts.
Pine nuts with butter. And then last but not least, a few of these little seared kumquats right on top.
Look at that. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, there's lots of stuff going on. Do you want to eat it?
Are you kidding?
I know it's early in the morning, maybe for cauliflower, but you're more than welcome.
I'd love to.
All right, let me get some spoon.
That is a big spoonful. Did it come out right? Oh my god, that's incredible.
Lots of fun flavors, and it's like acidic and bright, but it feels kind of rich. But it's actually really healthy at the end of the day. There's not anything in there. Maybe a little butter on the pine nuts, but there's nothing in there that's super bad for you.
But that whole combination is amazing. Now, did you, like, learn this, or do you kind of experiment? Because who would have thought, like, cauliflower, chickpeas, pine nuts, kumquats, garlic tahini. You got a lot of stuff in there.
There is. I think there's, like, kind of a formula to cooking this stuff. And the one thing that I think I really took away from working with Anna and working at Oleana for so long is that it's important to respect the flavor profiles that are sort of already existing. It's okay to be creative and change stuff around and to put your spin on it, but you should really understand the underlying basic profile of the food.
Now, you've been open for 4 years?
Almost. A little over 3.5.
And now you're a James Beard nominated Best Chef Northeast.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are you surprised?
I am, actually. Yeah. Yes, very surprised.
That's a short time.
It is. I'm over the moon. I'm very grateful, and I'm very honored, and I'm surprised. But on the same note, like I said, we have a very hardworking, wonderful group of people who work here.
So what's next for you?
Next, let's see. At home, I have two little girls. I have one who's 22 months and one that's 5 months. So... I gotta be honest, I'm pretty busy all around. When I'm not here, I'm with them, and when I'm not with them, I'm here. And I know everybody likes to hear about the next new restaurant that's opening and the next venture and all that, but for me, I really feel strongly about doing something and doing it well. And I think in a time when people are really quick to kind of like jump around and, like I said, always on the lookout for the new thing, I am more like, let's make this place great. Let's keep this super consistent. Let's keep, building this restaurant and growing it and making it the kind of place that people are going to come to for years on end, where people like just consistently want to come here and party and eat great food and drink and socialize and have fun and celebrate.
Cassie Puma is executive chef and co-owner at Sarma in Somerville. She's a James Beard nominee for Best Chef Northeast. For a photo of that cauliflower fa tea, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.